Let's go.
This is Power Pivot with Leela Sinha.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Power Pivot, the podcast where we talk about ethics, leadership, power, and community. Power can corrupt, but it doesn't have to be that way. Today's show may contain references to erotic and sexual subjects, so make your decision about where and how to listen appropriately. Our guest today is Nobilis Reed. Nobilis Reed is the creator, editor, and host of the audio anthology podcast, Nobilis Erotica, which presents erotic speculative fiction short stories every month. He is the author of Monster Whisperer, which was named one of the best sex books of 2017 by Violet Blue, and its upcoming sequel, Monster Whisperer Second Class. You can find his podcast on any podcast directory or at its website at nobilislibsyn.com. So nobilis.libsyn.com. You can find the nonsense that crosses his mind on Twitter and his deep thoughts on Medium, both as at Nobilis. That's Nobilis. Nobilis, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's always a pleasure to have interesting people, and you are very definitely an interesting people. We've known each other on Facebook for probably a few years now, but I don't think we've ever had a chance to talk before.
No, not to my knowledge. My memory isn't as reliable as it used to be.
Yeah, well, there's that. So this is a show about power, and I spent a little too much time in academia. So let's begin by defining our terms. When I say power, what does that mean to you?
Okay. There's a bunch of different ways to come at it, right? Because there's like a very specific scientific mathematical definition of power in terms of, making things happen in the sense of moving things around. Mm-hmm. Right? And you measure it by how much stuff has moved around. You know power in science by what it does. I think in interpersonal terms, it's often in terms of potential, in terms of the ability to change the world around you, mm-hmm. I like to think of it in terms of the connection to human rights. So like one of the human rights recognized by the United Nations is the right of movement, the right to decide you don't like where you are and to pick up and go somewhere else. Then I like to use that one because it's not one that's guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution. I love the dichotomy there. Because Americans tend to think of the rights that are in the Constitution as the only ones that exist. You can have the right to move and not have the ability to move.
Right. The means.
So somebody who's, if you're talking about like moving your place of residence, that can be a very expensive thing for someone who's in poverty. And it can be a very difficult thing for someone who's disabled. And requires a lot of excess, a lot more effort than someone who's in a better situation. So it's a combination of having the freedom to do something and having the resources to do it. That's the combination there for what kind of power means to me. And oftentimes it also has to do with the effect that has on other people. So, again, going back to that freedom of movement thing, if mom decides, okay, we're moving to Connecticut, the other people in the household, children, disabled, elders, what have you, might not have any say in that decision. Right. And if mom says it's happening, it's happening. Well, then she's the one with the power in that relationship, the power to choose where they're going to live. In the broadest possible sense, it's the ability to make changes in the world, especially those that affect other people.
So it's freedom or rights plus capacity. And it's the ability to change, your own world and the world of other people.
Boiled down to its smallest possible expression, the ability to make changes in the world.
Okay. What are the best things about having power?
Having power is a comfortable situation, right? It means that, you know, the more you have, the more, up to a point at least, I guess, the more confident you can be that whatever happens, you'll be able to handle it. And it kind of broadens your horizon. If you are struggling with really basic things, it's really difficult to think much beyond the next hour or the next day. But as those become less of an everyday concern, you can start thinking about next month, next year, 20 years, your kids, the planet as a whole, etc.
So you're talking basically about Maslow's hierarchy.
Yeah. The Maslow's hierarchy has a lot to do with it. Though I think that one of the problems that I have with Maslow's hierarchy is that it tends to downplay empathy and care about other people, because his highest value there is, I think, personal actualization. I'm not sure exactly if I have it right, but there's nothing there in Maslow's hierarchy that says, okay, I'm solid. I want to make the people around me solid. And I think that there's, you know, there's a level at which people can kind of branch out and want to improve more than just their own situation. They want to improve their community. Now, this is at odds with the idea that as people become more powerful, they tend to lose empathy. This is something that's been studied a great deal in psychology lately. But at the same time, I think there's kind of a middle ground where people are thinking about their community and they are thinking about the world that they live in, and they wanted the world at large to be a better place. And there might be a certain amount of self-interest there because, you know, if you have empathy, then seeing pain in other people degrades your own personal experience. So maybe everything ultimately boils down to self-interest, but it bothers me that Maslow's hierarchy doesn't really mention it at all.
Explicitly. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Self-actualization involves engagement with sort of the well-being of the whole world, as we see in a lot of religious spaces. Right, the idea that when you are elevated, then you're, of course, you understand that you're one with everything, you're connected to everything, that you want to be acting in, you know, if you have a theology that includes a God, you want to act in a godlike manner, right? You want to achieve that ability to have agape love for every being you meet. You know, I think that self-actualization is this really kind of mushy category, so it's possible. It I feel like it's in there, but you're right. It's not explicitly in there. And I'm looking at a reference right now. It looks like, you know, his hierarchy is from 1943.
Yeah,
so that's a really interesting moment in history to be creating a philosophy about how humans make decisions for themselves. You know, and I kind of, for me, I'm putting it up against Henry Nelson Lyman's what's that book? The Source of Human Good. Let me look it up. But there was a lot of philosophizing in the era, sort of right in the middle of World War II there, where people are trying to figure out, like, how do people make these moral decisions and how do people decide when their self-interest needs to cede to something bigger?
Exactly.
Yeah, it's called this. It's Wyman's The Source of Human Good. It's a book that I read in seminary, and it's for Wyman. It's Christian scholarship. It doesn't have to be set in Christianity, but you know, people are really obviously for clear reasons wrestling with human value systems and how they change depending on how much resource we have. So I think your point earlier that you know, power is not just the freedom to do something, but also the capacity to execute on whatever you want to execute. I think that's really important to think about. You know, I mean, freedom is in some ways it's an aspect of power.
You know, various philosophers have talked about, you know, kind of the freedoms arising from rights, right? And people have these rights. You have a right to do these things. And that's, you know, kind of, I mean, if you look at like the roots of it, that's a kind of a moral thing. Mm-hmm. That is, you shouldn't stop people from doing this thing. Mm-hmm. Whether it's moving around or saying what is on their mind or things like that. And especially, you know, with regard to constitutions and things, what governments should not, you know, interfere with. And I think that one of the things that we lose sight of is that there's a difference between nobody's stopping you and having the resources to go and do it on top of that. Like, one of the things that I'm often looking at when I'm writing is the way that power is negotiated and given and taken and traded and moves around in personal relationships.
Why don't we pause here for just a second and tell people a little bit about what you write in case they aren't already familiar with you.
I write erotica. I write with a science fiction or fantasy setting. My most recent book is Monster Whisperer, which is about a woman who gives advice to people who have tentacle monsters on how to best interact with them if they're dissatisfied with their relationship with their tentacle monster. It is part of a kind of a movement, a very small niche idea in the erotica world called consenticle, where tentacle monsters and humans have sexual relationships based on mutual consent rather than not. So consent is a very important aspect of the stuff that I write. And whether it's in that context or other stories that I'm writing or the ones that I'm publishing in my podcast. When it comes to a sexual relationship, power can really complicate consent. You know, if one member of a relationship has a great deal of power over the other, you know, how does consent work in that situation?
And I think that's true. And I think that's true even outside of sexual interactions. I think power complicates consent, period.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 It's, you know, there's no reason to limit it that way. It's just that that's how it interacts with what I write.
Sure. You were talking about how power appears, you know, how power affects your writing or how power is a part of your writing.
Okay.
And you were talking about power and consent and how they impact each other.
Yeah. For example, there's a story written by a colleague of mine, A.H. Lee, where you have a relationship between a sorcerer and a demon that the sorcerer has summoned and bound. So, or had in the past and has since released. And now the two are supposedly in an equal partnership rather than in a master-slave relationship. And at one point, the demon's off on his own doing some stuff, and he encounters a fairy lord, a fairy lady, actually, a very powerful fairy, and invites her back to the home with the two, the sorcerer and the demon share. And the sorcerer is like, "You invited a fairy in? What's wrong with you?" And really gets upset that the demon has done this. And the demon is like, "Look, I made a decision that I thought you guys could, you know, this would be an opportunity to have a diplomatic relationship between the two of you because this was, I saw an opportunity here and I wanted to explore it." And the The sorcerer needed to recognize that in order to be in an equal partnership, that the demon had to be able to make decisions on his own. And if that turned out to be a mistake, then they would deal with that together. But if everything has to be checked in with the sorcerer first, then it's not really an equal partnership. And I found that was a great way to kind of establish the equality of the relationship that in the past had not been. Once the sorcerer kind of realized where he had stepped over the line.
Do you think it's actually possible to do that?
I think it is. Power in a relationship is very complicated because you have all these different freedoms and powers that you have. And one person might have more power in one situation, and it flows and it moves and it's given and it's, and traded. And it is possible for a relationship to become more equal than it has been. But to say, you can say that having an equal partnership is your ideal, right? But like everything else in the human world, you know, you never quite meet your ideal. Nothing's ever perfect. But as long as you're working toward that, then that is ultimately the measure of you know, whether that's healthy or not. Because it used to be in the kind of traditional marriage relationship, and I'm going back to like the 19th century, that the husband would have decision-making power over a certain, you know, parts of life, and the wife would have just make power over other things, like, you know, how the household would be run. The idea that, you know, things would be set up any other way was not open to anyone, but there were particular spheres that were somebody's responsibility, and those were supposedly divided up. That was not an equitable division, but nevertheless, there were certain areas where a wife's power was supposed to be respected in matters relating to, for example, how children are raised. And I'm not saying that that's a particularly good ideal, but that is, you know, you can have situations where I give all the power over, you know, I give the power over this situation to you, you give the power of that situation to me, and that is, it's not equal, but it can be equitable. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. I don't know that I agree that it's not equal. I don't think you have to be doing the same things in order for something to be equal.
At that point, I think we're just quibbling over semantics about what equal means. But there's a difference between everyone is the same and things are divided up fairly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there are a lot of different ways to divide things, responsibilities, power, whatever, up. And, you know, we're in that sort of weedy part of philosophy where it's like, well, what's fair? So should we be striving for equal power for everybody in a relationship, in any kind of relationship, in a personal relationship, in a professional one? Like, is equality and power, is that our ideal? Is that what we want?
No, in fact, I think that there are times when, I mean, let's, you know, go into BDSM relationships. In a situation where someone has said, you know, in this space, in a sexual space between you and I am going to give you the power. And what I get out of giving you that power is that I can kind of let go of my, there's a comfort in not having the power when you give it to someone you trust.
And not having the responsibility.
And not having the responsibility, not having to make decisions, not having to worry about what's going to happen next. Just letting it happen, knowing that if things go badly, you can stop it. You retain that power, you know, the power of the safe word. But give everything else over, you know, allows a certain amount of clarity, a certain amount of freedom from worries and kind of getting stuck in your head and just letting go. And that is really attractive for people. So that, you know, no, I don't think that power needs to be equal at all times, but I think what is necessary is being aware of when power is being traded and passed from one person to another and that kind of thing. You know, that's where
how do you know
really
when you have power?
How do I know when I have power? Sometimes you don't, right? Sometimes you don't realize that you're the one with the power in the situation until you've kind of sat back and thought about it. And oftentimes the decisions we make can feel like there's only one right answer when maybe there isn't. And so we can have power and kind of be ignorant of it if we don't know what our options are.
So how do you become more aware?
I think taking time for introspection, I think, is one way to do that and to just kind of clear the mind and be out of the analytical mind can help. Having someone you can trust to talk about situations can be very helpful. I found that the best way for my own part to navigate that kind of thing is really having someone to trust to talk to about it. That's really, and even if they're not offering any advice, just to be able to kind of put their thoughts into words that are intended for someone else to hear and understand can often kind of order one's thoughts and open up awareness to things just because you're processing these things in another part of your brain. I find that that's when I get stuck, whether it's on some thorny interpersonal issue or something I'm writing and I can't figure out where to go with it next or whatever. Just sitting down and talking to someone about it is usually the best way to unlock, for me, to unlock what I'm stuck with.
So how do you choose who you do that with?
Well, that's not easy, right? Because it needs to be someone you can trust, but it also needs to be someone who's not necessarily directly involved with it, especially if it's an interpersonal issue. I'm lucky enough to have friends that I can go to with this kind of thing. And I have gone to therapists in the past with things, though not currently.
I guess what I'm asking here, though, is when we choose, like, I have a lot of friends and a lot of connections that are, you know, a lot of friends, a lot of acquaintances. I have a fairly widespread community. And when I think about who I would trust to engage me with power, to keep me accountable around power, to be the people that keep me able to be the person that I want to be or closer to the person that I'd like to be in the world, the way that I choose which people to engage with around that is very different from how I choose, you know, who to have a conversation with on Facebook. So how do you, when you think about, okay, this is a thorny issue, I need to call somebody up, I need to talk. What's your metric? How do you select the person or people who are on your shortlist for that?
the most important aspect of that relationship is trust, right? So
I'm not sure that's true, but go ahead.
Well, if you don't have that, then the rest of it's gonna, doesn't matter. I'm not, you know, there are other attributes that are important, but to me, the part of it that I'm not looking for their advice. I'm not looking for them to solve my problem. I'm going to be the one who solves it myself. I've learned that if I go to someone who's going to see the problem I present as something for them to solve, they're not going to be a good person to talk to. I want, you know, I generally want someone who's going to say, you know, I hear you. That sounds tough. And maybe occasionally, you know, have you thought about this aspect of what you're doing? Mm-hmm. The reason that trust is important is because I want to feel like there's not going to be a lot of consequences for opening up like this. Right. And the things I tell them are not going to get spread around. So, because ultimately, everything's going on in my own head.
So it sounds like you want to be able to be witnessed, to have somebody be present with you in your process, and witnessed non-judgmentally, even if the things that you think or say in your process are perhaps not your best self.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, that really gets to the core of it. And, you know, you can find that with a therapist. You can find that with, you know, various other professionals that you can hire and stuff like that. But the simple act of listening and, you know, as you said, witnessing and that kind of thing, I don't think is too terribly hard to find if you're the kind of person who also does that for other people, right? Is, you know, being that kind of friend to other people is the way to attract those kinds of friends.
And at what point do you think that listener, that witness, has a responsibility to call you in or call you out? Because we're talking about conversations about power. And, you know, I said, I said in my lead-in, you know, power corrupts, but it doesn't have to be that way. And that's my philosophy, is that there are ways to be with power that are not inherently morally destructive.
Well, I mean, you know, there's the legend, which may or may not be entirely true, that, you know, the kings of Europe would have fools who were allowed to say anything and not suffer for it. You know, they were culturally, you know, the king's fool was there to be the vocal present conscience and to mock the king if he was making doing something wrong. And I think that kind of relationship of having a friend who will say, I mean, I have friends that I pass manuscripts back and forth with when we're writing, and we're in very, you know, kind of alpha reader type things where we're looking at what we're writing as we go along and making commentary. And I have had places where I've been writing along with something, and one of my friends just pops a comment in that just says, "Oh, honey, no," which is kind of a cliche phrase, but it is a combination of you shouldn't be doing this, and I'm telling you because I care about you. It is, "Oh, honey," you know, an endearment, an expression of closeness, and "No, don't do this." And I think that just that little phrase can really be, when not used sarcastically, can be a very kind of an effective way for someone who's emotionally close to let you know that you're missing something, or you're overextended in some way, or what have you.
So how do you know, as the listener, how do you know when to go from I'm witnessing non-judgmentally to, oh no, there's a judgment about this?
If the person doesn't, in the process of expressing what they're doing, if the person doesn't hear it, the step before, oh honey, no, might be, are you listening to yourself right now? because usually, if you can get someone to kind of reflect back on what they just said, if they've, if they're expressing this way, and you can kind of get them to see it without having to point it out real hard. That is if you're dealing with someone who just doesn't have that kind of empathy in the first place, I don't think that's very effective. But, this is not the kind of relationship I would expect anybody to be able to have. I'm speaking very specifically about my own experience. And oftentimes when people, will tell me that, there's something that they're wrestling with or something like that, and having, I'm on the receiving end of this kind of conversation, they'll be going on and then, in the process of talking about it, say, and I know that there's something wrong with this, but here's where I am. Right. And so if somebody's already acknowledging it, then there's no need to stop them and point it out. But I think it's ultimately on the confessor's side to recognize it and make a change. The judgment side of things, I think, only really needs to come into play when the person who's at the greatest risk of getting hurt is not the person who's talking. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Have you talked to Sally about this? Where you might go when somebody's contemplating something that's not just something that they're wrestling with, but an injustice of some kind, some kind of harm. And I don't think that I've never had that kind of conversation come up, right? Where I'm, helping someone work with something and they're actively like contemplating something that would hurt someone else.
Really? You've never talked to someone who's actively contemplating something that could be hurtful?
Well, I mean, there's also the whole matter of point of view, right? Because, if a friend of mine is like, for example, contemplating a divorce and is, working through the troubles in their relationship and saying, I think that I just need to split up with this person. Well, I mean, that breakup is going to cause hurt in the other person. Right. But that doesn't, just because it's going to cause hurt doesn't mean it shouldn't happen.
Here we're in the territory of morality, right? Because it's not immoral to do something. It's not necessarily immoral to do something that will cause pain or discomfort.
Right.
And the question is, at what point does the situation become one where we are encountering a moral quandary, where the person is contemplating doing something that's, actually morally reprehensible. And when we get to morally reprehensible in some way, when we get to, or even morally questionable, then, for example, let's stay in the realm of relationships, but shift it slightly. This person that you're talking to, instead of contemplating a divorce, perhaps they're contemplating an affair and they don't have an open relationship. They don't have an open relationship agreement. So it's in violation of their covenant with their partner.
Yeah.
Right. Now, now we're in moral territory. Is it, you know, maybe their partner has decided they don't want to have sex and hasn't wanted to have sex for a long time, and they really want to have sex and they really feel like they need it. And they're, you know, I mean, there are people can rationalize, especially intensives, can rationalize absolutely anything if you give us 5 minutes and a scrap of paper. And so the question is, when we're in community, and especially when intensives are in community with other intensives, because we all, you know, almost all of us get really interested in this kind of theoretical moral space where you can just wrestle with the idea, and is this right or is this wrong, and when do you get to bend the rules and how far can I bend the rules, and it becomes an exercise in fun, right? We like to play with it. We like to be like, well, so if I did this, it's not technically against the rules, right? And that's how we get ourselves into a lot of wonderful things, and it's how we get ourselves into an enormous amount of trouble. So when we're in community with each other, I believe we have a certain amount of responsibility to call each other back to things like grace and kindness and a moral structure. And it's trickier if you don't share that moral structure with the other person, because then you have to choose whether you're going to step into their moral structure or invite them into your moral structure, or whether you think that you can find a sort of compromise moral structure, and who does that serve. But I do believe that there is some responsibility in human community, really anywhere. We've been talking mostly about a one-on-one conversation, but anytime we're in human community, I do believe that there are thresholds that we have a responsibility. When we cross that threshold, when we're in the realm of doing damage, that we have a responsibility to A, invite the person to face the magnitude of damage that they're going to cause, and B, invite them to engage the question of whether it's moral to cause that much damage. It might be, right? There might not be a better solution. And, you know, we humans live in the world of paradox, but to try to maintain moral neutrality in times of clear moral crisis, well, I think there are a lot of historical moments that will show us what happens when you do that.
Well, I mean, this goes to situations where instead of speaking one-on-one, instead of speaking in a very a situation where the trust level is really high. I've found that one of the things that I like to say in a if there's like a group of people, where someone has said something that comes across to me as being terrible, something that would provoke fear in a marginalized community, or would says something that needs to be called out. There's a kind of a construction that I have put together to use in those situations where I will say, what you just said seems to imply this, that, and the other, but you strike me as a moral, upstanding person who cares about the lives of other people. So that can't be the right interpretation of what you said. Can you clarify? And that has occasionally gotten very bad reactions, where someone will say, no, I absolutely mean to step on that child's head, figuratively speaking.
Well, thank but you so much most for being of the clear time, about who you are.
Yes, and now I know where our relationship stands. Or get them to kind of rethink what they've said in the guise of restating it, right? And it's kind of with dealing with certain people, sometimes it can be very useful to get people to reanalyze the way they're thinking if you give them a way to save face and to not have to say, oh, I was wrong. Because if you can get them to say, okay, let me rephrase what I was saying, and then behind it, they're changing their mind, but they don't have to actually say so, and that pretend that was the way they thought all along, is a can be persuasive.
Right. I mean, and,
it doesn't
and
work every time, but
now you're talking more about a public forum.
Yeah, this is in more public situations where there's more than just a couple of people.
But see, here's what I'm interested in. If you have, and maybe not one-on-one, maybe six people in a group, you know, but when you have a small group of people where the trust level is fairly high, or at least where you know each other fairly well, and you're having one of these conversations, you know, I think those are not times to maintain moral neutrality either. Those are the times, that's the space where you can say, oh, honey, no.
Yeah. No, yeah. That, I mean, there's different tools for different situations, right? And oh, honey, no is definitely that kind of tool. Yeah.
So what is our responsibility as people with power? Because I don't think I've got anyone lined up for this podcast at this point who has no power. What is our responsibility as people with power? In your case, you have a public voice, you have a public audience, you're writing for an audience, right? So the stuff that you write, you know, it obviously, you were talking about how it centralizes consent, and I think that's really important. You know, but what is our responsibility as people with power as we think about who we engage with and how we engage with them? And especially who we put in that small circle around us, our first and second ring consultants, if you will. What is our responsibility in terms of being part of those communities and forming those communities around us so that we are not corrupted by the power we hold?
I think one of the things that has helped me in that regard is that in being a writer, I'm often putting myself in other people's heads. You know, how would this kind of person react to this kind of situation? And that can be a very difficult prospect for someone who doesn't have a lot of experience with the lives of other people. So I, for example, in my own reading, I try to limit the amount of stuff that I read that is written by straight white cis men.
Mm-hmm.
At the very most, half of what I read is by straight white cis men. I try to make it even less than that. So I feel like by reading things that are written from points of view of other people, I can learn more about what their experiences are like, and be able to imagine better how they would react to things in my own writing. I don't claim to be an expert at this, but I think my writing is improved by diversifying the stories that I take in for myself,
and do you also diversify the communities you interact with?
Yeah. I mean, that's a little more difficult because my presence in a community will change the community.
Sure.
If I'm at like a convention or something and there's a group of women over in the corner talking and I go over and join the conversation, the energy immediately changes.
Of course.
So, and that's true of online communities and all sorts of things like that. There's several Facebook groups that I'm in where all I do is just sit and watch. I don't engage with anybody because I want to see how they interact with each other authentically without my like almost like Heisenberg observer effect, without
right.
my participation changing what's going on. So to some extent, that's a little like reading because these are these stories going on that I am kind of passively accepting. So I don't really trust too much communities that I'm participating in being able to teach me too much about diverse voices. So And that's not to say that I don't participate in those communities. I just don't expect that that's going to teach me as much as being able to see and receive those stories without trying to participate, without trying to prompt, without trying to ask too many questions.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I do think, though, that there's another level, which is authentic relationship.
Yeah, I mean, and if and that's kind of another level yet of that kind of thing. So, you know, but I don't want to be the guy who says, oh yeah, I've got a lot of
some friends of my best friends
people
are
of color and women. So,
right.
Yeah. Some of my best friends are Black. And it's like, that's not to say that there isn't value in that, but, that's always like kind of like the first thing people think of. And I mean, I've talked to a couple of my person of color, you know, my friends who are people, POCs, and they're like, yeah, I interact with my white friends entirely different than anybody else. You know, for example, I recently had a story submitted to my podcast. I'm a paying market. Somebody submitted a story and I'm like, this is an interracial relationship set in the antebellum South. Mm-hmm. It looks to me like you've handled this really thorny situation well, but I'm a white dude. I can't tell. So I hired a sensitivity reader for that story.
Sure.
And in fact, I'm paying them more than I'm paying the author. mm-hmm. I haven't got the report back on that story yet. So I recognize that my ability to empathize with those kind of situations is limited. I don't have all the answers personally. So, sometimes getting those answers involves, hiring somebody.
Sure. Absolutely. So when you think about the words, if I said, how does your community think about this? Or who would you think of if I said your community?
My community? Mm-hmm. There's the publisher that I have preferred to work with over the past 15 years has been a place called Circlet Press.
Uh-huh.
Founded by Cecilia Tan way back when. They're the publisher for Monster Whisperer, and every year they hold a retreat. They held a retreat up in Boston for all the authors and editors to get together and exchange ideas and socialize and have some fun and just to build a community around the publisher. It was a very participatory kind of thing. A lot of author publisher relationships are very singular. The author only speaks to an editor or a few people at the publisher and never to like other authors at the same publisher. Circlet Press was definitely not made that way. They definitely encouraged a community of all of the people who worked together on this. And to this day, the people that I met through that larger kind of engineered community have been a strong community for me personally to interact with the other authors and editors that I worked with there. That's been, as far as writing is concerned and, that kind of thing, that's been a strong part of that. Also in the podcasting world, I've made a lot of relationships with other podcasters who do similar things or completely different or what have you, around a science fiction convention in Baltimore called Balticon, which has a strong podcasting track, and especially podcast fiction, which is, when people think of a podcast, they don't usually think of podcast fiction. It's kind of it's becoming kind of its own special thing. And so, in that circle, I also have, kind of built my own circle of friends in that regard. Those have been my sources over the past 15 years or so. Did I drift away from the question?
Well, what I asked you is, what is your community? And you talked about your writing community and your podcast community, sort of your professional spaces.
Right.
Do you think of your professional spaces as your primary places to have community?
Anybody that I currently count as a friend, I met either through podcasting or through Circle Press.
So, yes.
I mean,
for you.
Yeah. Now, the thing is, though, you know, I have a day job, right? That's my other profession. I don't talk about it a whole lot. It's pretty boring compared to everything else. And I count the people I work with directly there as, you know, moderately close friends. They're not people I would talk to about really, you know, heavy things. Except as it relates to actually doing my job, right? Like, you know, if my kid is sick and I'm, you know, and I can't go into work that day, you know, having a sick kid is a heavy thing, but you know, all I'm going to get there is sympathy. Nobody's going to ask if they need to come over with a bowl of soup. When you say professional, you know, there are different kinds of professional communities, right? And especially when it comes to things like writing, we're not really in competition with each other at all. You know, our individual successes and failures don't have very much influence on each other. There's a certain amount of ability to recommend each other's work to our audiences and things like that. But for the most part, you know, if you get if I'm just thinking about, you know, the people sitting around my table at, I'm sitting in the bar at Balticon, and I've got my friends around me. You know, there's the guy who writes horror, and the guy who writes mystery, and the guy who writes thrillers. And when I say guy, it could be any gender. You know, the author who writes romances, and the we are all together in this podcast fiction world, but we all have our own separate audiences, and we kind of all succeed and fail on our own. So that means that because we're all succeeding and failing on our own, it means that we can be more honest and open to each other about the difficulties and successes that we're having, right? If you have a bunch of science fiction authors together, and they all write like military SF or whatever. You know, if somebody says, "Hey, I just won this award," there's going to be just by natural human feelings, there's going to be a certain amount of black in the emotion that goes along with it. There's going to be a certain amount of envy. There's going to be a certain amount of jealousy. A certain amount of bad feeling associated with it.
Yeah, I would steer away from using black as a metaphor for that, but. But I mean, and now you're in the territory of compersion, right? Are we able to have compersion? And compersion is obviously a word that comes out of polyamory. It comes out of the idea. I'm just, you know, gonna give a brief definition here. Compersion is the ability to basically have joy for somebody else's joy or enjoy somebody else's pleasure. You know, if somebody that you care about is having a good experience, that you want to have that experience too. So I think that you know, if you're sitting around a table of authors and one person won an award that you all went for, then there's like, oh, I wish I had won that award. But the one hopes that in a strong community, the overarching feeling is one of compersion, that it's like, oh, yay, you won an award. Congratulations. You did a really great job.
Oh, yeah. I'm not saying that that's impossible. What I'm saying is that compersion is more difficult in a situation where there's a great deal of commonality between the people to go into polyamory, for example, you know, imagine that you've got a couple who have decided that they're going to open up their relationship. Tracy and Joe, the first person that Joe goes and creates a new relationship with outside of Tracy and Joe looks an awful lot like Tracy and acts an awful lot like Tracy. Tracy is going to feel, going to have a harder time with compersion than if they're completely different.
Maybe.
Maybe. what I'm saying is that there are feelings that can get in the way when there's a lot of commonality in the community. That if there's a lot of diversity in the community, not as much. Or when, at least that's what my experience has been. Uh-huh. Is that if I'm in a community with a bunch of just plain authors, we can really share what's going on very easily without having to worry about competition starting to be an issue. But the narrower you make it, where the group of people you're talking to are all very similar, I think trust becomes harder and harder. That's been my experience. I don't know.
That's really interesting, because to me, it's easier to trust people whose experience is close enough to mine that I can believe that they understand my experience.
Huh. Okay. I can definitely see that. I see what you're saying in terms of identity. I'm talking more in terms of activity, of what you're doing rather than who you are. But
I think that's a whole other rabbit hole.
I'm willing to accept the idea that I'm wrong.
Well, I think there's a whole other rabbit hole there of how do our identities interact with our behaviors, right? At what point does I write become I am an author?
That's another whole hour of that.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I want to circle back before we end. I want to circle back to one thing you said a little bit earlier. You said, you know, there are different kinds of professional spaces, and you were referencing in that case your experiences with organizations like Circlet Press and your experience at your day job that you don't talk about very much, and where you have this sort of more distant relationship with your colleagues there. And yeah. What I'm interested in there is in what ways telling ourselves that there's a difference lets us off the hook about holding each other accountable in spaces where it might be uncomfortable or risky. Do you know where I'm going with that?
And I'm trying to think of like, if somebody in my podcasting community or somebody in my Circlet Press community or somebody in my day job said something really racist, which I can't imagine happening in any three of them, but let's just posit that somebody says something like that.
Or maybe they said something really subtly sexist, which I can totally imagine happening.
Yeah. If somebody said something really sexist in one of those situations. Let me give, this is something historical. In the podcasting community that I was part of, somebody had an affair, was cheating on their spouse several years back. And it was one of those things where, since it was happening at the con, pretty much everybody knew about it. And it was, you know, there was a discussion kind of going around. It's like, all right, do we tell their spouse about this, or is it our business?
And did anyone talk to the person?
It was also like, you know, like, hey, dude, we don't want to see that here. You know, that kind of thing was, I was not particularly close to that person myself, but I was in discussions about what people were talking about doing. And eventually someone did go to him and say, you know, look, dude, you know, your business with your wife and your spouse and your affair is your business, but don't, I mean, you in by doing it here in a really kind of open way, you are involving us in it. And we don't like being in this situation of knowing about this and, having to figure out what we're going to do. That was the ultimate thing that the way that it was presented to them. I think at my day job, first of all, it'd be unlikely to anybody ever found out. But even if they did, I don't think that anybody would say anything. I think it would be much more of a, this is nobody's business but theirs situation. And in my Circle of Press community, I think people would probably be like, well, we don't know if they have an open relationship, so let's just not worry about it.
In none of those communities, it sounds like, would you expect anybody to sit down with the person who's doing the thing themselves and not say, you're making us uncomfortable by involving us in a situation that we don't think should be ours to be involved in, but say, listen, is this the kind of person you want to be?
I don't think any of those communities, I don't think that kind of conversation would be impossible. But I don't think it's likely. I don't think any of them would really come across in a kind of a. I've never been in a situation where someone in one of the close communities that I'm part of has done or said something that crossed the line into, this is just plain wrong. There's no justification for it. You know, and the community has, you know, called them out on it. It's happened in kind of in like the broader senses, like the recent stuff with J.K. Rowling and trans people.
Right.
You know, I don't have a personal relationship with J.K. Rowling, but you know, I agree with the people who've been like, "Oh man, that's really not cool. That's really not cool." And I'm trying to, you know, if somebody like in one of my closer circles were to do or say something like that, I would definitely feel like, hey, that was just plain wrong. And I can't sit still for that. But it's also never happened. And I'm not sure if that's just a matter of me being ignorant of it or, you know, of people like who are in the community. And I don't discount the possibility that that is, or it's just that, you know, I've got good friends.
I
feel that way.
Right.
To some extent, I mean,
at any community has a set of moral standards that's going to, at some point, there's a threshold, right? Excuse me, you're planning to murder someone in cold blood. That's really unacceptable. You have to not.
Yeah.
But what I'm interested in, because these conversations, this podcast, what I'm interested in is the conversations about the slightly more liminal spaces. You know, folks who have followed me in any context know that liminality is one of my big things, and that I spend a lot of time and a lot of energy and a lot of thought on what it means to be liminal, because so much of my identity and my experience and my life are about living kind of understanding that the borderland is not a line. The borderland is a space, that there's a place here that is between.
Right.
And and so what I'm interested in is, I mean, when it's clearly wrong, when the person is standing there with a gun to somebody's head and is like, I'm going to murder this person in cold blood for no reason, right? We don't have a problem usually being like, actually don't.
Yeah.
With, like, this is not really going to work for us. You're going to have to come up with a better solution, right? And when it's clearly morally right, you know, when someone's like, look at this starving baby, I'm going to put food in its mouth. Nobody's in our circles anyway. Yeah. Nobody is going to be like, oh, that's a terrible idea. Right. So what we're looking at is the liminal space of, you know, this person appears to be having an affair. What is our community response? Is our community response to say, oh, well, you know, it's not my business, la, la, la? Is our community response to confront it, but in this indirect way? Or is our community response to actually engage our moral responsibility as a community around this person and to say to the person, hey, let's have a conversation? Like, it might be that you have an open relationship, but if you do, we as your community would like to know that that's okay, so that we can continue to act as a community in health around this, because right now we're becoming a community in dis-ease around this. And so one person going and saying, listen, your community needs to know what's going on, or going to the person and saying, listen, this is what it looks like. Is this, if that's the case, is this the person you want to be? Because asking people not just, are you crossing some egregious moral line, but asking people, is this the person you want to be, is really, I think, where the make or break line, you know, we tend to say the make or break line of corruption and power and, you know, immorality is way out at the edges with the gun and the person's, you know, like, and it's not. I think the place where our collective morality cracks is actually much closer in and much more liminal.
That's where things get complicated, right? That's where things get, and one could say where things get interesting. And, you know, I tend to try to look for those spaces in my writing to say, you know, how can this situation be more complicated? Because it's more complicated is generally speaking more interesting. Mm-hmm. The human drama becomes more interesting when the questions are thorny, you know, when you're not sure exactly where the line is. I don't want to get into tooting my own horn, but there's stuff like that going on in my novels. But there's a difference between experiencing that stuff through a story and living in it, where, you know, being in that situation is really uncomfortable to live in real life. People have a natural inclination, I think, to avoid those things if there's a way to say, there's also a liminality of morality, right? There's a liminality of is this wrong, or is this just uncomfortable, or what? You know, in this spectrum of between feeding babies and shooting people in the street. But there's also like the spectrum between this is absolutely my business to handle, and I really shouldn't get involved. And it has to do with, and there's all kinds of considerations between that. There's all kinds of reasons why someone might justifiably say, I should not get involved in this, right? If the price to themselves would be tremendously higher than the benefit to anybody else of getting involved, then, you know, you could make an argument that they should not get involved. you know, at the very least, you know, getting involved with one thing means you can't get involved with something else. So there's that whole question too, and how deeply to get involved. It's really difficult to speak in generalities in this regard, because people have to navigate in individual situations, especially in these liminal spaces, can be so complicated that, you know, it's hard to put a rule. It's hard to draw a line that says at this point you should make a judgment and tell the person that you've made a judgment. Right? You can't just, now it may be that as a culture, we should be making these judgments more. That's definitely a thing. Right. And I kind of hear you saying that we should be more willing to sit down with someone and saying, you know, I think what you're doing is wrong. Maybe saying it in a less confrontational way.
Well, and I think part of where I'm going is, as individuals with power, it is our responsibility to invite people to do that, right? Because you're right, there's a cultural resistance to doing that in this culture. Some cultures are different, but in sort of mainstream United States culture right now, there's a resistance to that. And so in order to have the kind of moral accountability that makes it possible, ethical, safer, in the same way that sex can't be fully safe. I don't necessarily know that power can be fully safe. The way to be safer power holders, my argument, is that the way to be safer power holders is to have communities of accountability around us. And the way to have a community of accountability in a culture of non-involvement is to invite it. And so it changes the relationship and the question and the conversation entirely. If I have had a conversation with you and I have said to you, listen, you're somebody who's important to me. You're somebody who I trust. You're somebody who I value. And if you think I'm out of line, I need you to tell me, because I'm out on these skinny branches doing this stuff, right? I'm, you know, a lot of the people I talk to these days are founders of companies. Right. I'm out on the skinny branches doing this stuff. Right. I'm out here where I have to blow off a certain amount of naysaying. Because if I don't, I'm never going to do something revolutionary. And I'm interested in doing something revolutionary. But you understand the difference between doing something revolutionary and doing something morally reprehensible. And I need you to help me stay on the right side of that line. And if I have an agreement with you about that, and not just you, but a circle of people, that makes it possible for me to cantilever myself out further than I could otherwise without breaking the branch off and hitting the ground.
Yeah. And I think it's useful to look at it from a community point of view, where if one person in the community says, well, I got to say something, and they, you know, walk over to the person and say, is this really what you want to be? That's, I think, less effective than if three people walk over and say, Tracy, come here, sit down. We're worried about you. And the person you're becoming, or what's going on in this situation.
Right. I mean, the structure of how you approach someone also depends on the person, depends on the relative power, right? We're right back to power.
Yeah.
Somebody has a lot of community power, somebody who has a lot of influence and sway, is probably going to be less likely to be approached by one person, more likely to be approached by three people, because there's going to be this intuitive sense of balancing out the amount of power in the room, right? But that's where I'm going with this, right? Is this idea that I don't believe that we're in a place culturally where this is going to spontaneously arise. I think we're in a place culturally where, as the leaders, we have to take responsibility for forming those communities around ourselves.
speaking as, I don't consider myself to be, well, okay, maybe I'm wrong. I need to look at this. This is not something I've actually thought about. Am I a leader in any of the communities that I participate in? You know, thinking about my Balticon friends, am I a leader in that community? I don't know. I've never actually talked to any of them about whether they consider me a leader.
Are you a power holder, though?
Yeah, to some extent. I'm on the staff convention, and I schedule some of the events that happen there. So that is institutional power in mm-hmm. that community that not everybody in my community has. But at the same time, it's also like, this goes back to like, you know, where's the overlap between power and service, right?
That's another whole hour.
Right, it's another whole hour. That goes back all into BDSM and all kinds of other things. But you know, I have always looked at that participation and that thing of, okay, I'm going to think up 9 hours of stuff to do at the convention that people will find interesting. I've always thought of it as a service that I provide to the community, but it's pretty clearly also power. And I think now that you've kind of brought that up, it does make me a leader because I am making decisions about what is going to be available for people to experience at the convention. So, that's something I think I need to just go back and think about more because it's not something if you had asked me 15 minutes ago whether I was a leader in that community, I would have said no. And now I kind of have to realize that the answer has to be yes. So
isn't this interesting?
So then that comes around to what is my responsibility with that power? Right. And, you know, one of the things that I have done, you know, with that power is to make sure that underrepresented people are well represented at the presentations that I organize.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to invite people onto panels who are, you know, diverse people, not just the same old people every time. Consciously making sure that that is handled appropriately.
So it's an interesting thing, right? Yeah. I mean, when I asked you earlier, how do you know that you have power? You gave me some interesting answers, but this is why I think those questions are important because, and I'm confronting a lot of this in my own life right now in a variety of different ways, that once you realize that you have power that you didn't realize you had, then you immediately have to start thinking about, well, what's my responsibility with this power? How do I use this power well? How do I make sure that this power doesn't corrupt me? All those questions come up. And so many of us have been taught to believe that we don't have power, that we're not in leadership. But when we take a solid look at the place we hold in society, at the things that we do in public, whether or not we make money with them, because money is understood to be a correlate for power a lot. You know, when we start to look at where we hold power and when we enter an analysis with the assumption that we must have power in here somewhere and look for the power rather than entering with the assumption that we must not have power in here somewhere, that power belongs to other people, it's over there, it's up there, whatever, then I think we end up in a much more robust conversation. But we also end up with understanding that with that power, whatever it is, comes our ability to change things, to change the world, which is, of course, where we started. So we need to wrap up because this is fascinating and could go on forever.
Yes.
Do you have any last words? Do you have anything that you would like to leave our listeners with?
I think that the point that I kind of came to this wanting to emphasize was that power complicates consent. And we never really got too deep into that. And just power complicates consent, and that in situations where there's a power imbalance, that people need to be very cognizant of how they might be coercing consent without knowing it.
Right, which comes back to what we were just talking about. Because if you don't know you have power, you might not be aware that you're coercing consent.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
And where can they find you online?
The big thing with me these days is my podcast. You can find Nobilis Erotica at nobilis.libsyn.com, N-O-B-I-L-I-S dot L-I-B-S-Y-N.com. That's pretty much my hub these days. You can, if you look up my name in any, you know, ebook retailer, you'll find all kinds of stuff I've written. So that's the best place for me right now.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a fascinating conversation. I'm going to have all kinds of fun in post trying to edit it down to an hour.
And I am so sorry for that. I know I'm being a podcaster myself. I know how much of a pain that can be.
I am not in the least bit sorry. Speaking of consent and power, I could have cut us off 30 minutes ago. And I think these conversations are really important, and I'm glad to have them. So I really appreciate you coming on, and I look forward to following you in the future.
Thank you so much.
You're so welcome. And that is the end of our podcast. Today we were speaking with Nobilis Reed, who writes erotica and has written books about monsters and tentacles and consent and power. And I suggest you check out his work if that's the sort of thing you're into. If it is not, please allow yourself to be excused. And we look forward to seeing you again on this podcast.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Power Pivot. We'd love to hear from you. Please rate and subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. To support Power Pivot and get early access to new episodes, go to intensivesinstitute.com/Patreon. For information about coaching and consulting, or to book Lila for a talk or workshop, go to intensivesinstitute.com.